the optimal life.
So how close were you years back? How close were you to ending it all?
I had plans for it. I ruminated on it very, very frequently. I actually felt myself like I was ready to do, like I was, I used to walk the streets at night, just hoping to be hit by a bus because I didn't want to do it. I was too afraid of causing my wife and family more pain. And so I didn't want to end my life and create a mess for them. And then that ended up being some reason why that I considered myself a weakling, because I didn't even have the courage to end my own life. You know, it became a source of even self-recrimination, even by not doing it.
So you're beating yourself up. You're saying I'm a pussy for not taking my own life is the way you started thinking about your thoughts.
Yep, exactly.
Wow. And you would think to yourself the easiest way would be to just jump in front of a moving bus.
No, I didn't think that would have been the easiest way, but I didn't have access to guns and artillery and pharmaceuticals or anything of that sort. And so I just felt like that was the most convenient way. That was the one that I would ruminate on the most because it would look the most like an accident.
Do you remember when those thoughts first started creeping in, the ideation?
Yeah. See, I was newly married. I hadn't had them before, like my undergraduate career in college. I was dancing on a dance ensemble. I was doing something that I really enjoyed. I had met my wife there. And then afterwards, I had to get down to the business of surviving and being a head of household and putting food on the table and whatnot. And we started having children. And then I went to graduate school. It was a graduate school in painting and drawing. So this is like visual arts. I'm there in Seattle, which is not the greatest place to be suicidal or depressed. And weekly, I started having these critiques where the faculty would come and be like, what are you thinking about? Why are you painting this way? What are you doing? And I was already down on myself from all this religious conviction about the use of pornography and my wife not liking it and some of the other things that I was into. And so I was already down on myself. And then it was like everybody else was on me too. And that's when it started happening. I had some really dark self-portraits that I did at the time, just trying to process how I felt.
How many kids did you have at this point?
At this point, we had two children.
You had two children. And now you're a father of four. Is that correct?
Six.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. So, well, you've got me beat. I thought I had a lot. I have four. So I've got a ways to go, man. I'm only 67% of the way there, apparently. So you had two children. You were fairly newly married.
Yeah.
You're in graduate school. What were some of the things you talk about the porn? And I know that's a big one. So let's start with that. Things that were causing you heartache and anxiety and angst. Let's start with the porn.
Yeah. I had grown up in a really religious culture, very, very strict Mormon culture, and pornography, masturbation, sexual sin, as it was called, was heavily frowned upon. But I was also a curious teenager when, you know, younger, wanted to know how the plumbing worked, wanted to know how all the things worked. And my dad, for better or worse, just didn't know how to talk about it, didn't have answers because he felt awkward about it and whatnot. And so I ended up finding the answers on my own in art books. And then, you know, the internet shows up and I found pornography online, started experimenting. And then somewhere along the way, put two and two together that what they were talking about in church was the thing that I was doing that was wrong. And in that religion, somehow I interpreted it as slightly worse than murder. And so I had this complex that I had carried that, like, I've already messed everything up. I'm already a worthless piece of shit. You know, there's no coming back from this. And so I was just trying to cope and do the best I could. That is what I had carried from teenagehood in. And then as my wife got involved in other things, she starts feeling bad about it because, you know, she's wondering, like, why am I not good enough? Why are you using this thing? It took me a long time to, like, realize the problem with that way of thinking. But at the time, that was like a really heavy load, my own worth before God at the time.
So you exploring sexuality, masturbation, you started equating those, I mean, normal activities, especially as you're a teenager and you're figuring it all out. You started equating that to sin. Is that?
Yeah, very much. And I think that that's a fairly common view in a lot of religious denominations. And I don't know that everybody, even in the Mormon faith, would think the way that I thought at the time. It's just the best that I could make sense of the situation. I started equating it not just to sin, but as to like some of the worst, most heinous sins you could possibly do.
Right. You were worse than the Jeffrey Dahmers of the world in your own mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially.
That's so wild. I wonder, and that stemmed from you started having those. I'm a horrific person. You had those as young as a teenager, you said.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does that manifest then as you go into your adult life with the pornography? What does that look like in terms of how that starts affecting your every, like, what are you thinking about when you don't have the porn in front of you, what are the thoughts?
So what's fascinating is this same process happens with everybody who ends up with some thought about themselves, regardless of what it is. So, you know, the thought I had about myself was essentially that I was some defective creation of God's that had massive issues and was just made that way and would never be able to get out of it. Other people might feel like they're worthless or that nobody loves them or that they're a disappointment or they'll never measure up or whatever kids make sense of in the world. And that becomes, as an identity, your identity is something you have to protect, right? Even if it's gnarly, it's the only thing you know of yourself. So you still got to survive. So to protect this sense of myself being broken, I did things that proved to me that I was broken. I would self-sabotage many times, or I would procrastinate or not accomplish or not finish things on time. But then I also did things to try and prove it wrong, to try and edit my sense of self. And so I was like a big people pleaser. I had amazing grades in school. I would go over the top on certain things. I excelled in the martial arts that I was training, those types of things. Mm. And so it was this hodgepodge of almost a paradoxical life. On one end, being outgoing and performing well, and on the other end, doing things that kind of reified and made sure that sense of worthlessness was there, and that included pornography. So when I wasn't thinking about it, most of the day, I was just trying to do what was right. I was just trying to do what was right. And then when I wasn't so uncomfortable in my own skin, those are moments where I would allow my own natural gifts to come to the surface, and I would have these cool ideas and I would engage with things. So it's not like I had a miserable time all the time. And I don't think anybody that is in that state feels that way. It's just that, you know, it comes so heavily that it feels like it's there all the time.
So when it comes heavily, is that when it gets quiet typically, when, hey, the martial arts is not, you're not doing that, you're not busy with the painting, when you have a little extra free time on your hands, is that when you're sitting there in your own quiet thoughts, when it's like, whoa, here comes the porn stuff, I need to go distract myself?
Yeah, so distractions are a way to kind of keep out of it. But pornography was also something that could be triggered by. And then, so if I'm if you and I are having a conversation and I'm super nervous, or you say something that disagrees with what I do, and I have that initial reaction on the inside, that would fester and ruminate for a period of time. And then I would end up having like arguments with you, right? Fake arguments about how I could have done that differently, how I could have proved that I was right. Because I didn't want to face up to the music of like feeling like, no, I just messed up or something. Okay. And so that I would ruminate on things for long periods of time. And then pornography was, in a way, a lot of people look at addictive behaviors as a way to numb out or to escape. I look at them the opposite way. I look at it as some person's attempt to wake up from their own nightmare. They're not trying to numb out. They're trying to feel something real again. So whether that's with a substance, like I did many psychedelic drugs and trips in that regard for a number of years, or whether that was with pornography or something else, it shut down my ruminating mind and got me back in touch with the sensory world to remind myself, oh, wait, things are great. And even some of the people I've worked with who cut themselves, you know, they would say, like, I wasn't doing it because I wanted to die or I wanted pain. It was just that when I did that, it was the only thing that existed. Like I was no longer stuck in my head. I could feel again.
Wow. So you just want to feel. You just want to feel something.
Yeah.
In those moments. So what would you feel, Bob, when you have the porn and you're done after however long you're watching it or consuming it? What were those feelings during and then immediately thereafter? How quickly does that dopamine rush that you were chasing, I assume, goes away fairly quickly.
Yeah. So this was a great question that I asked myself a number of years ago when I was coming out of it, and I was mostly kind of clear of it. And I realized there was a morning I was up. I've just finished my workout. And I was like, I had this realization, oh my gosh, I like porn. And then I was like, no, I'm not supposed to like porn. That's bad. And then the question afterwards was, why do I like it? And that's when I started answering the question that you just posed. Such a great question. Well, let's see. The feeling inside was total freedom. I had control over what I was looking at. All of my worries were in the background. So I was not dealing with the weight of my own thoughts. There was an adrenaline rush because there's a sense of risk inside of it. And I could feel the chemical flush run through my head. I could feel a slight jitters in my fingers, or like the coolness that comes from like my heart beating and stuff. I could feel a sense of like emotional connection and being wanted. I could feel obviously the stuff that came from ejaculation or masturbation and the pleasure that went in there. And all of that built a certain kind of experience. I could feel myself breathing differently and all those things. So then the next question was like, where else in my life do I feel those things? And I was like, well, shoot, like an adrenaline rush, I get those from certain things. And, you know, obviously sexual pleasure is its own different variety, but there's all kinds of different pleasures where I feel myself come alive and where I'm being challenged and where I'm learning new skills. And I built this list initially of all the things that I do that help me feel like I come alive again. And I started putting those into my life as well, which started essentially weaning me off of pornography as the only thing that could help me come alive again. Afterwards, so there's those initial things, and obviously there's the risk, and like, I hope nobody sees me, you know, there's the, like, I'm paying attention to this thing with utmost focus, but somehow I'm also aware of the tiniest sound in the background. And, you know, is the garage door opening? Did I hear something down the street? So it's this hyper-focused awareness that, you know, sometimes happens when you're in a life or death situation. And afterwards that dies down. There is still the chemical relaxation that's happening. So the negativity doesn't fully hit for immediately. My thoughts would start running like, oh, see, you did it again. Oh, never again. Or I would make some decision based on willpower, or I would say, oh, you're such an idiot. And then I'd have to like think about, do I need to tell my wife? Do I not need to tell my wife? Is this something that I can hide? Let me go delete the internet history or something of that sort. So the thoughts would run, but the body still takes a while to come back off of its negative, off of that kind of sexual experience. And so I did get some level of relaxation, some level of release. And that's how most people talk about it. They're like, look, I just needed a release. A release from what is the question?
Right.
And that was where the journey toward really understanding the nature of addiction began, that flew in the face of so much of what I've been taught.
How did that impact you, your relationship with your wife, both the intimacy and even the emotional aspect? Did it have some form of negative impact on both? And if so, how?
Massive negative impact. I will never know what it's like to have a marital relationship that is not informed by Disney movies and pornography. I mean, that's essentially what I learned about relationships. You be a good guy, you be a nice guy, you save the damsel, and then everything will work out. You'll get married and all of your problems will go away.
Whoever told us that was lying to us like there was no tomorrow, right?
Right. And then the other side was this portrayal of sexuality as if it is the ultimate human experience. And as if that alone cements the value of the relationship and the intimacy and the connection. And so I was, from the get-go, looking for the same signals from my wife that I saw in pornographic material. Is she moaning the right way? Is she having the same kind of facial expressions? Is she doing? And when she wasn't, I was internal going like, I'm not doing it right. Oh, it's horrible. She doesn't want me. She doesn't like me. And so I had this inner running dialogue for years, thinking that despite all the evidence to the contrary, that my wife had stayed with me for all those years, that she didn't actually want me, that she did not desire me, that she was just with me on some pity case or something else like that.
Wow.
That made me hold back.
You were doing that same self-sabotaging thought that you did with the masturbation as a teenager. I'm a sinner. I'm worse than a murderer. Now it's, I'm not good enough for my wife. She doesn't like this. She's just with me because she feels bad.
Yep. Yep.
You just create these stories.
Uh-huh. Wow. It's pretty common. A lot of the people I've worked with, they have similar stories. They don't realize that they're creating them. They think it's the truth because the way that your brain works is that it makes a guess about what's going to happen based on your thoughts without any physical feedback to the contrary. It just assumes it's right and then rewards itself for being right. Dopamine.
Right.
Like, I knew it. I'm worthless. And like, there's some weird hit from being right. And so I reinforced that because I wasn't telling my wife this. So I was holding back because I didn't want to be rejected. And so then she was in this place where she was trying to connect, but she was quiet, you know, from a Japanese family, and raising your voice and being passionate was not how they operated. And so we were misreading each other's cues left and right.
Right. Right.
And then eventually it starts where she will run when she's feeling rejected or she feels judged by me. And then she would go talk to her family and I would talk to friends
Let me just interject real quick, Bob, because those misreading of cues, the different cultures, is only compounding the situation. It's actually making you feel like, oh yeah, I'm 100% right in my thoughts because we're not communicating on this in the same way.
Right. Exactly. Mm. Exactly. There's so many things that compound the situation, both individual personality and then cultural differences and religious differences. Eventually I chose out of the faith that I grew up in and she's still a member. And so those things changed a lot of that and compounded the issue for sure.
Mm, interesting.
So then we ended up not having a deeply connected relationship, not because either of us didn't want it, but because I was coming with certain expectations. She was coming with certain expectations. Neither of us were communicating. And so I'm running stories in my head. She's running stories like she feels like a backup dancer and like second best. And we weren't able to get together for a long time.
Now, you guys are still married today or did the marriage dissolve?
No, we're still married. Yeah.
You guys are still married because I know that you were going through a real tumultuous time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Between that and the suicidal ideation. So the pornography thing is happening. Are there anything else that's causing you severe angst that's creating these stories in your head? Like, hey, it'd be better if I just get hit by a bus at this point.
You know, what's interesting is I wouldn't classify my childhood as traumatic. My father was a fighter pilot. We moved around a lot. So I often felt like a social outsider and was always trying to fit in. You could call that something of like that definitely primed the pump to me, feel like I was weird or off or something like that. But that's about the only thing that was going on. I couldn't make money as a grad school artist. So there's that. So there was some financial stress that was built into it, but I started a Kung Fu school down in Arizona and I was running that and doing the best I could. We were on food stamps for a time, but like we had food on the table. So it wasn't overt. It wasn't over the top, a huge stress, but it was a part of it.
So from the outside looking in, people would have been completely stunned because you were the outgoing guy.
Yep.
You were friendly. You had relationships. You had the Kung Fu school. You had a lot going on, family, a wife, kids.
Yeah.
On the outside, everything looked fine. On the inside, you were torturing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a double life almost.
Yeah. Very, very much so. Very, very much so. And it led to a lot of, let me put it this way. I got a lot of mileage out of that double life. The amount of depression that I was dealing with, I used to my advantage. It gave me permission to not work as hard, to not try to make as much money for the family when times were tough. It allowed me to have to get pity from other people from the people that knew about it and to use that in some kind of leverage. It was a survival mechanism. Going into those depressive states is a survival mechanism. And I got a lot of mileage out of it until I realized what I was doing. And then I was like, maybe that's not the best thing.
What was the moment? Is there that one rock bottom moment that was more intense and severe than all the others?
There were two. First one that happened was it finally came to a head one night. We had four children at this point. So in your situation and my wife, we had been married 8 years and she was like, I'm done. I can't handle this anymore. I don't know how to deal with this. I think I'm out. And that night I was like, oh crap, I feel this way already. And now I'm going to have to feel this way and be alone. So that sparked this sort of willpower. I've got to control this. I've got to do something. She stuck around only because of some sort, she had some kind of experience where she caught a glimpse of what it might be like in my, inside my own skin, and her heart broke for that. And so she was like, as long as he's trying, we'll see. So she stuck around, and about 6 months later, she left to go grab the kids from school. Since I was teaching martial arts, my, most of my job was at night, so I'm at home. And she leaves, and I'm in my office, and the used car salesman in my head starts, you know, he's like, act now, Bob, while you got the chance. The computer's in the corner. No one's going to know the wiser. You know how to delete your internet history. No one will be hurt. You've had done it 1,000 times, you know. And I'm running there, and the same thing, heart's beating, hands jittering, like cold sensation runs down. I feel this dramatic pull toward the computer. I'm standing rooted to the spot, and I have this vision of myself at 90 years old in the same room, having the same struggle. And I was like, at that point, I didn't want to kill myself, thankfully. And I was like, I can't do another 6 decades of this. Like, I do not want to live that life and get to the end of it and say, my biggest achievement is that I managed to not look. I got things I want to do. And so that was the moment that I was like, I am throwing out everything. All the 12-step stuff, all the counseling stuff, all the programs I've done, anything that has not worked, as beautiful as it's been, I have to figure out what's going on. And I have to change it now because this is not okay with me.
Wow. Real quick, what was it about that night 6 months prior? Did something specifically happen where she said she's done?
We were trying to have sex, and it wasn't really satisfying for either of us. And at that point, she was like, all right, I need to know the depth of how far you've gone. I need to know what you've done. Because we'd talked around it, but I'd never just sat there and been like, okay. And so I was like, these are some of the things I've done. I've looked at a lot of pornography this way, this type. I'm like, I'll tell you as much as you want, because I was already broken. And I was like, see, I'm broken. I'm just telling you stuff that proves that I'm broken. So I was playing the story. And then I told her about the chat rooms that I had not gone into for fear of being of my credit card information being traced, but I had sat there as a voyeur on the outside, like wishing for it. And that's where she was like, that's no longer videos. That's like a living, breathing person that you're like kind of going after. And so is this, I don't think I'm okay with that.
Right. Is this infidelity in some form of way? Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. That's incredibly intense. And that's what I found talking to people that have overcome things. Mm-hmm. You know, all the programs, the 12 steps, the this, the that. Sometimes it's just the epiphany of, I can't go any lower. I need to throw it all out, and I need to do this my way. And I need to just rip the Band-Aid and do this. So what did you do that day, Bob, or the next day, or the days or weeks that followed to get yourself into this new life and back on track?
After I realized I can't do this anymore, I was like, I had been told I was an addict. There's still some debate in psychological circles about whether pornography usage is termed an addiction or not. It's not in the DSM. There's indications that your religious views on the matter sort of dictate whether or not you'll compulsively use it or not. And I didn't want any of that. I was like, I need to know what's happening. And I need to know it in a way that an average bloke who doesn't have access to millions of dollars of lab equipment and research grants and all this other stuff can do something about it. I don't have the money for pills and for expensive prescriptions. I don't have insurance. I was a martial arts school owner. Like, yeah. I don't have anything. I need to know how to handle this from the inside out. And so I started questioning. Well, the first thing that came to mind was, well, whatever came in has to get out. I've got to just vomit all this stuff up. And I was an artist. So I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm okay. I told my wife, I'm like, I'm going to sit down and I've got to get this stuff out. So I turned on some hopefully inspiring music and I sat down. And I'm like, I'm just going to draw this stuff out and then maybe it'll come out. It was a bad idea. It was horrible. I made some really good pornography.
Yeah.
And so then like 45 minutes in, I'm like, I can't, I'm just getting really hopped up on this. And so I went and burned it in the backyard and I was like, I don't know. And then I started writing what the next idea that came was like, make a list of people in your life. This would be like addressing resentments in a 12-step program, whatnot, but it was this is a list of like 92 names. And I sat down and I wrote each of them a letter and I just let everything come. These were to porn stars, to the industry leaders in pornography, the makers of YouTube. These were to my grandpa who died before I got a chance to say bye to him. To any name that came to some people that are positive influences and not. And I just got all of this extra emotional baggage off my chest. And I felt one, it took 4 days, 5 hours a day writing. Of just vomiting all this stuff up. What I did was I wrote and then I would read it out loud so that I could hear it. And the reading of it, like while I was writing, I was emotional and I was in that space. While I was reading it, I was almost seeing myself from a third person and started to feel a sense of compassion toward myself. I was like, wow, that kid is carrying a lot of stuff.
First time you ever felt that way?
Yes, very, very much so. Guilt, shame, I was a pro. Compassion toward self, not so much.
Right.
And I started seeing patterns in there as what you might call root issues, core things that would, you know, thought processes that were recurring and whatnot. And I was like, wow, I felt amazing after that. The triggers started diminishing and I realized, wow, my emotional buildup is somehow related to whether or not I'm going to be compulsively acting out. Interesting. Tell me more. What's actually happening? So I started looking at root issues for a while, thinking that these limiting beliefs about myself were the thing. And how do I decommission this limiting belief without having to tell my story over and over and practice it? So I started looking at that for a bit. And what I started noticing very, very directly that was that I could measure how much I believed something by how much my body reacted to it. So if you called me a 7 foot tall green gecko, my reaction would be very different than if you called me a girl when I was in junior high age, right? Very different. Because at that age, maybe I don't know what a girl is or not a girl is. I got other identity issues. And so there's some belief about whether I'm man enough. But gecko, not a problem. And so I realized, wow, my physical reactions are actually the measure of whether I can tell whether I'm free of something, which was a better metric than, well, it's been this long since you've acted out. Because I was only looking at pornography when I felt depressed, when I felt tired, when I felt stressed, when I was bored, when I was by myself, and these thoughts would come. Well, if the thoughts no longer came with an emotional, physical reaction, then they came and went like reading signs as you drive down the street. So I was like, whoa, okay, that's cool. How do I decommission my physical reaction to these things? And that's where the real journey into let's leave psychology behind. And let's look directly at the body's responses to its environment showed up.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. How do you then take all that and those physical reactions and this new outlook on life? And I mean, how do you say I'm going to ultimately start changing people's lives? I mean, I assume that that doesn't happen overnight because you got to fix yourself, which has to take a nice period of time.
Yeah, I'm actually, it doesn't take as long to finally be free of it, but it took me about 4 years to be comfortable talking about pornography right. In public. It's one thing to say I used to be a drug addict. People seem to have some level of respect for somebody who's overcome drug addiction, but to say like, yeah, I was the pervert next door. Like people just have this thing, you know?
Yeah, why is that? What is that? What is about that, do you think?
I think in some ways, like sexual crimes, like rape and stuff, have a lot of emotional impact.
Pedophilia, they related to those kind of things potentially.
Yeah. And so there may be some protectiveness about their children that they're worried about. They can't control your eyes. Oh, he's undressing me with his eyes. That a drug addict doesn't sit there and like look at you as a piece of heroin, you know?
That's fair. That's a fair point.
So they don't want to be treated by like objects. So it took me a good 4 years. And really what pushed me into that, I mean, I had gone and trained with Russian operatives and I'd traveled to India and I'd done all these other things to try and really figure out the mechanics of what had happened and how I could maintain this. But it was really, we were going through bankruptcy. I was trying to figure out how to make ends meet. And I had a business coach like get in my face and say, dude, martial arts and teachers are like a dime a dozen. There's nobody on the planet that understands pornography addiction. They don't understand these other types of addictions. They don't understand them well enough to be able to tell them it's possible to leave it behind. The narrative is you're going to cope with this for life. And if you've really done this, I'm in front of 500 guys. I'm on stage. I'm terrified. He's intimidating. He's taller than I am. And he's these guys are looking at me. So I'm on the spotlight and he's like, are you sure you're done? Like, you're done, done. You're not just looking at it in the closet and you're lying to us here. And I was like, no, I'm done. How long has it been? 4 years. Has it been my brain? I'm doubting myself now. I'm like, has it been 4 years? Maybe I'm lying. I'm not sure.
You know? Right. Right.
And he's like, if you really know how to do this, there are people suffering.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He's basically saying, if you want to have an impact, an everlasting impact, go this route.
Yeah. And I thank heaven for him and for what he was able to do and wake me up to this. And then he turned around and he's like, you got 3 days to put your story online. And I was like, yes, sir. And I went home and I have something of a knack with speaking. So it wasn't like death defying, but even recording that first video, I was like dry heaving off take, you know, because this is me telling about the impact that it had on my children.
This is your coming out. This is your coming out story to the world, which is scary as hell.
Yeah. And I didn't tell my family in advance. I didn't warn my family. So they saw it online and was like, wait a second. What?
Yeah. Your wife's going, wait a second. Where did this come from?
No, my wife knew, but her family didn't. She had some police officers in the family. And so they were like, this is too much information to have online, you know?
Yeah.
And, but it was very, very difficult. And at first I only started working with guys who were dealing with pornography and sexual issues, because that was something I could speak confidently about. It was only later that women were asking for help and they were like, is this only for men? I'm like, well, no, I'm just teaching them how their body works to create emotion and reaction to emotion and how you can start to train that to be different on the inside. And so we started having women come to retreats and other things, and they were dealing with depression and sexual assault from the time they were children, and anxiety, bipolar stuff, body image issues. And then we had people coming with chronic pain issues and autoimmune diseases, and the same processes were helping. And so over the years, it started to expand to helping more people in more situations.
It's evolved. The Freedom Specialist, that's Bob's company, a body-based approach to happiness, health, and well-being. We've linked it up in the show notes. I want to talk a little bit about those and the retreats, but real quick, back to those letters. I'm just curious.
Yeah, sure.
You wrote some letters to, you mentioned the porn stars that apparently you were watching, and also to YouTube. So what was the content of those letters to both of those?
So the project I gave myself was, if I'm going to write to this person, I have to no longer keep the, I have to no longer censor myself. I have, because if I'm censoring myself, I'm just basically keeping the worst stuff in and letting the good stuff out, and nobody's going to be around. So I need to let it all out. So with the porn stars in particularly, those letters were filled with all the things that I wanted to do to them, which included, I mean, this was stream of consciousness, so I wasn't planning this in advance. It included sexual acts, but it also included violent acts, because I hated them for being there and for being an object of desire. Not obviously the person, I don't know them in real life, so whatever they represented online, but they became sort of a symbol of the hatred that I had toward all of this desire inside myself. So
it was almost like, but for you, I wouldn't have these problems.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, you're the cause of my demons and I want to hurt you.
Yeah. Kind of an outward blame sort of thing. In the middle of that would escape all of the inner blame and all of the truth about the way that I couldn't control myself and stuff. But it was mixed in with all of the outward blame that humans are used to doing. I mean, it's intuitive. I feel bad. What was the last thing that happened? That's probably what made me feel bad. Mm. It takes some awareness and perspicacity to look inside and realize that the bad feeling never came from that. So most of it was outward blame. YouTube, those were the people that were creating a platform that porn could exist on, or soft porn or swimsuit stuff or whatever would lead me down the rabbit hole. But I had other people on the list. I had the IRS. I had Democrats and Republicans both. I had kids from elementary school who were popular kids, and I didn't feel popular, and I just had jealousy toward them, and I didn't think it was fair. So all the temper tantrums that I never allowed myself to have because I needed to be a good kid, I gave myself permission to just have the temper tantrums in a really contained space with enough music in the background to keep me from going down the rabbit hole. Like, so sure. It was inspiring music that, so if I started going down a rabbit hole, I could stop and I could tune into the music, and that would keep me going rather than going downhill, kind of thing.
This was a complete cleansing, a cleansing of the soul. Wow. We're getting close to finishing off. We already mentioned the Freedom Specialist. You guys are doing some phenomenal looking programs and retreats. Give us a little glimpse into, you already have kind of teased it, but talk to us about what people can experience, the type of people you guys are really helping and how you're helping them overcome some of these difficulties.
Yeah. So what I started doing was programs online to teach people things they could do at home with their movement, with their breathing, with their posture, with their thought processes, to start to decommission all of these triggers and trauma responses and to dismantle them so that their body is no longer reacting. Because if their body's no longer reacting to the thought can come, it can go. They don't need to cope because there's nothing to cope with. So I started teaching them that way. Choose Your Own Emotion is that first program that a lot of people have got a lot of benefit from. I built it like a video game, sort of. It's, you know, level one, level two, you know, it's goofy, dumb dad jokes. You know, I wanted to keep it exciting and fun.
Right. And that's the 20-day digital adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. So 2 weeks, you learn basically, one, how your emotions are built, what they're made of, and how we start you with a basically evening and morning routine that you can customize as you need to as time goes on. But something to start with to start to change your overall baseline mood. How you wake up in the morning. It's like you can use it as an alarm and 15 minutes and you wake up feeling very different. And that sets the mood for your day. And then the second week is dealing with emotions in the moment. We teach them emotional ninjutsu because I was a Ninja Turtle buff growing up. And so
who was your favorite? Who was your favorite? Michelangelo?
It was Michelangelo.
Totally Michelangelo. Everybody's was Michael. I think mine was Donatello. I'm pretty sure.
I really liked Donatello second. They were the two that were the big ones. Leonardo, I thought, was too stuck up.
What a great series. They don't make those anymore, but anyways.
Yeah. And so emotional ninjutsu, ABLE, how to acknowledge, breathe, loosen, and escape from all of the emotions that are there. And so we go through that process. And the third week is, how do I deal with thoughts about something that are creating a reaction? And how do I start to dismantle those? So I teach a process that I also introduce in my book, called the delete button, where you're taking these memories and you're sort of taking control over the reaction that they produce in you, like adding a little flag on the end that says, hey, this memory has a happy ending, so you don't need to worry about freaking out about it. And that way you don't have to sit there and like talk through all the trauma. You can just like boom, 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 get rid of it, delete it, and ta-da, it doesn't affect you anymore. So that's 3 weeks. And people go through that program multiple times because just to reinforce it and to help them understand it's great. At a certain point, I realized that I could accelerate things in person because I knew that most of the stuff that I had done was very, very physical in nature. Retraining the way that my body moved, the way that it breathed, the way that it reacted to threats. And so, I mean, I went and trained with like the Russian special forces and not the special forces themselves, people who had been in them and, you know, fighting in the water, fighting with knives, fighting in the woods, getting whipped, beaten, punched, all these other things, and learning in that process, it wasn't about winning a fight, but it was about understanding my own responses and learning to dissipate those responses. And I was like, man, let's create something for the people that I'm working with that's not that intense, but that has a really profound effect. And so in these retreats, yeah, we have them tell their story in the beginning to kind of get it off their chest and whatnot. And then most of the rest of the time, I'm just helping them see like, this is a neuron firing. This is the only thing we have to change. The reaction to that neuron, that's it. And so we take them through physical exercises. We take them through different types of breath work. We do work with knives. We work with sticks in a fun sort of playful way, not in a like a, okay, you better get this or else. And the point is like, if I bring a knife to you and let's say I put it on your skin, your body's going to have a reaction just to have some other person holding a knife on your skin. And those small reactions are where people fall. They think that they fall because it's a big reaction, but it's the buildup of the tiny in discomforts. And so what we're teaching them to identify on those days is, hey, look, are you uncomfortable? How long are you going to wait to recover? And so it's not, they don't have to win at all. They're just going through an experience. Every time they feel uncomfortable, their job is to learn to identify it and recover, identify it and recover, so that it becomes a muscle memory of every time something grabs their innards, they let it go.
Yeah.
And
go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we go through those, and then we take them through some periods of stillness where they got to be with their thoughts and show them what to do in those places. We do some sensory deprivation stuff. We put them through an ice bath, you know, like basically I'm having them map the terrain of their nervous system and discover in the process that no matter where they go, they're okay.
It's a beautiful thing. It looks incredible. I would imagine there's no better feeling in the world than when these people have those breakthrough moments with you. And they're emotional and they're hugging you and or they're saying goodbye after the weekend. Hey, you just changed my life. That's got to be the most rewarding feeling.
It is. I mean, I almost call it sacred. Like there's something really profound in seeing that this person no longer has to suffer something. I will tell you that more rewarding was the first time that like one of the people that works with me, he went and took what I had shared with him, and then he went and helped his sister. And then she gave this feedback that she no longer was feeling like she needed to kill herself and all this other stuff. And I had never spoken with him. And it was even more rewarding to see that something I had created could be passed on and produce that effect without me having to be micromanaging it. That was even more beautiful. Then there's this legacy feeling.
That's beautiful stuff. Again, the Freedom Specialist, Bob Gardner, we've linked them in the show notes, guys. Take a look. We've also linked your book, Built for Freedom, and the podcast, Alive and Free. You guys could check those out as well. Final question, Bob. Someone's listening. They may be struggling with anything, but let's focus specifically still with the porn addiction.
Sure.
Someone that's going through the exact same thing, and they feel similar, if not identical, to the way you felt for many years. What's your message to those folks?
There's nothing wrong with you. The fact that you are having a compulsive behavior means that your body and brain are working the way they're designed to help you survive situations that you don't currently have a better solution for. So there's never anything wrong with you. This has helped you survive to this point. We don't need to be to lampoon that or anything like that. What we do need to do is just give yourself another option. When your body, not just your brain, when your body knows in and of itself that there is a better option, it will automatically choose the next one. That's the only thing you have to give it.